started here. You can hear me in the back? Okay. We got a lot of material to cover. As you should know, this is the panel on animal rights and Mormon obligations. My name's Scott Smith. I co-authored a book called Animals in the Gospel. And Dr. Robert Youngblood is my co-panelist, and he is a plastic surgeon in Salt Lake City, and he's also a speaker for the Humane Society of Utah. If you're interested in what we're talking about today, you may want to sign up on the sheet that the Humane Society of Utah has out in one of the tables in a corner over there, and then they can get you involved in their projects, and they have quite a bit of free literature you can take there as well. We'll start out with an overview of some of the statements of the church leaders, and Dr. Youngblood will talk about the 19th century, and then I'll talk about the 20th century.
I'd like to talk a little bit about cultural consciousness. That's kind of a catchword these days if you're into metaphysical things. But I think that one of the greatest metaphysical thinkers in time was Joseph Smith. He had a great deal to say about animals and the responsibility of human animals in taking care of our lesser brothers, if we can call them lesser brothers. From the Time and Seasons, which was published in Nauvoo, Illinois during the lifetime of Joseph Smith, he is quoted as saying, "Let men attend to these instructions. Let them use the things ordained of God. Let them be sparing of the life of animals. It is pleasing, Lord, that flesh be used only in times of winter or of famine, and white to be used in famine, because all domesticated animals would naturally die and may as well by man." When I speak in my priesthood group about the second page of the Word of Wisdom, I find enormous ignorance about this particular matter. And they interpret it quite differently than I do, and in my opinion, quite differently than what Joseph Smith did. This idea about animals being used for food only in times of famine, when otherwise they might die or man might preserve his own life at their expense under the permission of God, has been throughout many of the teachings of the prophets, especially the early prophets. We don't hear it much these days, but I'm sure that Dr. Smith will address that. A story is told about in 1834 when Joseph Smith taught a lesson concerning the rights of animals, when after pitching tents one night, three rattlesnakes were found, which some of the men were about to kill. Joseph commanded them not to hurt them and explained that the serpent will not lose its venom while the servants of God possess the same disposition. Further, he declared, man must become harmless before the brute creation, and then the animal kingdom will follow. We've already quoted from the Word of Wisdom, but I'd like to go further about it, what it says, beyond the idea of not using meat except in winter, times of cold and famine. All grain is ordained for the use of man and beast, to be the staff of life, not only for man, but for the beasts of the field and the fowls of heaven, and all wild animals that run or creep on the earth. And these hath God made for the use of man, only in times of famine and excess hunger. The prophet also leaned very heavily on the words of the prophet Isaiah. I'm sure we're all familiar with the quotations from Isaiah about pounding the sword into the plowshare. They certainly didn't say, Isaiah certainly didn't say, pound the sword into a hammer to be used to hit animals in the back of the head to kill them. From Isaiah. In that day the enmity of man and the enmity of beast, yea, the enmity of all flesh, shall cease from before my face. Pardon me, that's the prophet's comments about Isaiah. In speaking of the idea of cultural consciousness, I feel that we have what we could properly define as a kill mentality. In the Ten Commandments, when it says, thou shalt not kill, does not define what should not be killed. I don't think that God has left so much to our own interpretation that if he meant only that we should not kill man, that he would not have said, thou shalt not kill thy neighbor. But he said, thou shalt not kill. We only have to look around us to see that man has not learned not to kill his neighbor, much less the animals. We're all familiar with the things that are going on in the Middle East at this time, and the quickness with which one country has killed thousands of people in another country, basically because of greed for money. Because the big dispute between Kuwait and Iraq, as I understand it, is that Iraq feels that it's been cheated out of some money for some oil that's along their border. Now, I've heard these kind of statements from both of these countries. We have been very quick, and I do not say it's proper or improper, but we have been very quick to send thousands of our own young men into harm's way to defend not our land, not the lives of our wives and children, but oil. More specifically, the price of oil. This is what I determine is a kill mentality. Now, I don't have all the answers as to where the kill mentality comes from, but I can't help but think that it comes from the way that we teach our children about life. Because certainly, if we do not value the lives of animals, it's not much of a stretch to say that we do not properly value the lives of man. One of my favorite quotations from Scott's book is from Heber J. Grant, when after being the prophet for, I guess, some 27 years or so, he attributed his own health to the fact that he rarely ate meat. As a matter of fact, he said that in all of the time that he ate at the Hotel Utah in the cafeteria, he did not eat meat more than a dozen times. And I think that this idea coming from the prophets, as it has throughout all of the scriptures, that we must value life, we must take responsibility for the life that we've been given charge of. I think that this idea is something that has muted in our modern times. And I'll be very interested to hear what Brother Smith has to say about what's been going on in the 20th century.
The interesting thing about the idea of reverence for life is this has been one of the most consistent doctrines taught by the prophets, and yet recently it's been one of the most neglected. Lou Regenstein, who's an officer of the Humane Society of the United States, has been working on a book for the last 10 years. Now, my book, Animals and the Gospel, was published in 1980, and he wanted an update. He wanted to know what had happened in the last 10 years. What had the church leaders said on this subject? And unfortunately, I had to tell him nothing has been said in the last 10 years. But in the past century and a half, virtually every major church leader and the prophets had something to say about the subject, some of them quite vociferous. Probably the most outstanding leader of the last century was George Q. Cannon, And even Brigham Young, one would not think of him as being particularly sensitive to animal life. Hugh Nibley has an essay called Brigham Young and the Environment, which appeared in a BYU publication called To the Glory of God. It was a collection of essays. And Nibley himself has been one of the most vocal proponents of reverence for life the church has ever had. In fact, almost every time he does a social commentary, like his sesquicentennial address, Oh How Firm the Foundation, had comments on reverence for life. But anyway, Brigham Young and most of the prophets have had things to say about it. Now, my book went out of print basically a couple of years ago, and anybody who's interested in it, I'll Xerox it for you for $3 and send you a copy of it. We tried to get Deseret Books and Bookcraft to reprint the book, but they wouldn't do it for one reason. They couldn't make enough money on it. I think Nibley would have a few choice words about that attitude. In any event, consequently, most members of the church don't even know that LDS doctrine on this subject exists, except when it uncomfortably asserts itself every so often. The greatest advocate of humaneness in church history was President Joseph F. Smith. And for about 18 years at the beginning of this century, he had a lot of statements to say about every manner of subject. He, for example, really strengthened a program that was in a Sunday school called Humane Day. And the Sunday school kids were taught every year about the importance of reverence for life. And he said, at one point, when every soul gets into the condition of mind that he will go out of his way to ease the sufferings of dumb animals, then many of the cruelties now complained of will disappear from the earth forever. And he felt it had to start with the children. And he said that kindness to animals was the absolute duty of mankind. Specifically referring to killing birds, he said, it is not only wicked to destroy them, it is abominable, and he could never see why a man should be imbued with a bloodthirsty desire to kill, it being, in his view, wicked for men to thirst in their souls to kill almost everything which possesses animal life. Now, most of you have probably heard his famous statement, because Spencer W. Kimball quoted this, and it's been quoted many times, about hunting. He said, it is wrong, and I've been surprised at the prominent men whom I have seen whose very souls seem to be athirst for the shedding of animal blood. They go off hunting deer, antelope, elk, anything they can find, and what for? Just for the fun of it. Not that they are hungry and need the flesh of their prey, but just because they love to shoot and destroy life. I am a firm believer with reference to these things in the simple words of one of the poets, take not away the life you cannot give, for all things have an equal right to live. Joseph Fielding Smith and David O. McKay and Stephen Richards signed a statement in 1918, which was endorsed later by Heber J. Grant. So it was, in essence, endorsed by three presidents of the church: David O. McKay, Joseph F. Smith, and Heber J. Grant. I just want to read a few selections, since this is the preeminent statement in terms of the number of prophets who endorsed it. We are a part of all life and should study carefully our relationship to it. We should be in sympathy with it and not allow our prejudices to create a desire for its destruction. The unnecessary destruction of life begets a spirit of destruction which grows within the soul. The unnecessary destruction of life is a distinct spiritual loss to the human family. Men cannot worship the Creator and look with careless indifference upon His creation. Men learn more easily in sympathetic relationships to all life than they do in the seclusion of human interests. Their minds are more open to the manifestations of that inspiration which all nature gives to those who lovingly enjoy her. Wisdom and virtue come from the animal and vegetable world, which carries with it a spiritual as well as a material blessing. Nature helps us to see and understand God. To all His creations we owe an allegiance of service and profound admiration. Love of nature is akin to the love of God. The two are inseparable. Now, I don't think that represents the sentiments of most members of the church today, particularly in Utah. I would say it's more progressive than most of the environmental stuff that's been written from the secular world. During Joseph F. Smith's presidency, there was also a book published that was authored by Elder Janosch Odahl and Apostle Hiram Smith, called the Doctrine and Covenants Commentary, and this was also reissued by the first presidency. I think it was under President Joseph Fielding Smith. And there was a commentary on Section 49, which deals with the eating of meat. which I think summarizes very powerfully what the LDS attitude should be. And they said, and mind you, this was republished by the First Presidency, to kill when not necessary is a sin akin to murder. Now, in the half century after Joseph F. Smith, the statements were a little more sporadic. Each of the prophets did have, or most of the prophets did have something to say. I think, as far as I can remember, President Lee didn't really leave anything along this line. But President David O. McKay was very active. I would say he was at least as active as Joseph Fielding Smith in pushing the idea of reverence for life. And Boyd K. Packer compared him with Albert Schweitzer because of his quality of mercy and his reverence for life ethic. And during his presidency, he spoke in General Conference briefly about the subject. The last time was in 1951. And nothing was said in General Conference again on the subject until 1978, when President Kimball talked about it, and we'll get to that in a moment. But during his presidency, the Mutual Improvement Association printed something on a little booklet on hunting and fishing, in which they said that even if varmints were killed, the admonition should be to avoid the enjoyment of it, and that if a boy saw a deer, neither the first nor the second thought should be to kill the deer. These are pretty strong statements in the context of the times, and they certainly aren't in harmony with the ethic today. During his regime, Lowell Bunyan wrote an article on the subject for The Instructor, and there were a number of other things that were summarized in this statement, that man has been entrusted with sovereignty over the animal kingdom. He may learn to govern as God rules by the power of love and justice. Joseph Fielding Smith was quite outspoken on a lot of topics, and among those were hunting. And he said, "It is a grievous sin in the sight of God to kill merely for sport. Such a thing shows a weakness in the spiritual character of the individual. We cannot restore life when it is taken, and all creatures have a right to enjoy life and happiness on the earth where the Lord has placed them. Only for food and then sparingly should flesh be eaten, for all life is from God and is eternal." And both Joseph Fielding Smith and his father were vegetarian, and they asserted that meat was not eaten flood, it would not be eaten in the hereafter and during the millennium, and therefore it was the proper diet for mankind. Joseph Fielding Smith also said, "It is intended that all creatures should be happy in their several elements. Therefore, to take the life of these creatures wantonly is a sin before the Lord." And there are quite a number of other statements along this line. 1972, Melchizedek Priesthood Manual reprinted Joseph F. Smith's statements on the subjects of reverence for life and hunting, and I remember it caused quite a stir in our priesthood quorum when this was printed. It hasn't been reprinted since. 1972 was one of the best years for the church in terms of a focus on this subject. The New Era had an article by Hugh Nibley called Man's Dominion, the October issue. The Ensign had an article by the person who co-authored Animals in the Gospel, Dr. Gerald Jones. And there were a number of other books which came out on the subject. Then there was some focus on the word of wisdom and the idea that members of the church were really consuming too much meat around 1977. 1978 was one of the most significant years because President Kimball twice in April and October conference spoke out about hunting in particular and mentioned that he rarely used meat. And if any of you can recall, when he made his comments about hunting, there was a fierce reaction from the members in Utah, to the point that I now understand that the general authorities have more or less been admonished to stay away from the topic. I find it incredible. I mean, I'm all for democracy in the church, but when the prophets are told not to talk about certain subjects because the members would be upset, that seems to reverse the role the way it's supposed to be. Hugh Nibley, in 1978, also wrote in an article called Subduing the Earth, which was printed in Nibley on the Timely and Timeless. He said, "Inquiring about today, one discovers many Latter-day Saints feel the time has come to put an end to the killing." Now, about this time, I was at BYU, and I talked Nibley into giving the address to launch a group called Reverence for Life, which was an LDS humane group. We started out calling it LDS Reverence for Life, but the church objected to our use of LDS, perhaps because they didn't want anybody to think that members of the church believed in Reverence for Life. I couldn't understand it because all these other independent groups were able to use Mormon, LDS, whatever they want, but they had us take it off our name. And he launched the group. We created quite a stir at BYU for a number of reasons, particularly with their livestock department and the science center. But from that time, we let the group go on for a couple of years and then turned over the operations to the Humane Society of Utah. We would like to reactivate that group. So if anybody is interested, if you sign up on the Humane Society of Utah's table out there, we'll put you on a mailing list in case we do resurrect this group and don't get excommunicated for it, then we'll try to pursue this. I did write the first presidency recently about the problem of the last 10 years or so, 12 years, nothing being said on the subject in general conference, and I knew at least a couple of the general of the apostles hunted at one point. And so I said not to give my book to them, but I thought if President Hinckley might know one of the general authorities who was particularly sympathetic, perhaps he could pass on the book, and maybe one of them would say something in conference. And it was thereafter that I heard through someone else's bishop that the first presidency, while they commended the ethic of humane treatment of animals, they really didn't want it talked about in general conference. But the church curriculum department did do a literature search for me. I didn't ask them to, but they sent me a long list of things that appeared in the various lesson manuals on Reverence for Life. Most of them, unfortunately, are for little children. I think the last lesson on the subject is for teachers. I guess it's dangerous to discuss it after that age. So the adults in the church seem to be a little retarded on the subject of animal rights. In any event, we'll now get into a little more depth on some of the specific topics. And let's just go back to the question of hunting. The problem with hunting, as it's practiced in Utah in particular, by members of the church, is that you'll notice that when people talk about hunting, they'll say, well, we don't hunt for sport, we use the meat. Now, the problem with that is these guys also call themselves sportsmen, and they're going after game. So if this isn't hunting for sport, I don't know what it is. I dare say that if they followed the ethic of the prophets and went out and had no joy in going out and killing the animals, that the hunting business in Utah would collapse overnight. Perhaps this is one reason why they don't want the subject discussed at all. I think the attitude should be like the Native Americans should be, that if you have to kill, if you feel compelled to go out and hunt for food, then you should do so with regret. It should be a tragedy to have to take an animal's life. Utah's record on humane treatment of animals, on hunting, and a lot of other issues is pretty abominable compared to the rest of the country. Here we are, the church, with the strongest ethic of reverence for life of any Western religion, and we have a vastly worse record than the Gentiles. So clearly this is a very neglected principle. But I would say that this should be the message to members of the church who want to hunt, is to do it with a sense of tragedy, and then let us see where that leads us. I have met a lot of former hunters in the church whose consciences were pricked by the reading the words of the prophets, and they stopped hunting. Perhaps Dr. Youngblood can say something about that. I believe you were a hunter at one time.
Yes. I'm one of those guys that's a gun lover. I don't know what it is about them, but I just love them. And I've been hunting probably a dozen times in my life, and I want you to know I'm very proud of my hunting record. Never hit a thing. My favorite movie character is Bambi. It's my understanding that each year the state of Utah issues about 300,000 hunting licenses. Now, I'm not sure if that figure is accurate. I really don't care. I'm not interested in hunting. I'm not interested in the statistics particularly. I probably am a miserable failure as far as Brother Smith is concerned on talking to you about hunting, because I don't want to spend my time studying about hunting. I regret that my sons and son-in-laws do hunt. And that they teach my grandchildren that that's okay, because I know that it is not okay. It's very well documented in the writings of Brigham Young that hunting should only be used as a necessity and not for any kind of sport or fun. As a matter of fact, his ire was provoked when on the trek out to Utah, many of the men in the caravans would shoot buffalo all day and leave most of them lying on the prairie. We've all heard stories about that sort of thing. And the Mormons are not guiltless where that is concerned. He went on to say that flesh should be used sparingly in famine and in cold. And the prophet told the women to stop the children from eating meat, and especially fat meat, suggesting that they eat vegetables and wholesome bread instead. He felt that prosperity was taking its toll because the pioneers were indulging in too much sweet cake, plum pudding, roast beef, and so on, blaming this as the cause of increased disease among them. He also blamed rich food, especially beef and pork, for shortening lives, claiming that the foundation of longevity, living even to the hundreds of years, would be found in a prudent diet, especially of our first parents in Eden, who we assume ate only fruits and vegetables. I don't know much more that I can say to you about hunting. I know that it's a risky sport. A lot of humans are killed on the hunt. I've been out staking areas of property that's owned by an animal rights institution here in Salt Lake, during the hunt, to be sure that people did not trespass on those areas on which hunting was forbidden, and noted that while we were out staking our signs up, every once in a while a bullet would whiz by, hit the trees. And it's obvious that people who are hunting often are very careless about it. It's also obvious that quite often they inflict a great deal of pain and suffering on animals who are gut shot, or an extremity is hit, or something like that. Because if a person can in any way justify hunting, it's my feeling that he must first develop the greatest skill in firing a firearm, that he never misses. He never misses a vital organ to render the animal dead in an instant. Otherwise, it can be nothing but cruelty to animals.
I might add, when I was at BYU in my botany class, we were talking about ecological problems, and we were talking about the number of deer and how they needed to be trimmed down. And I found out from my professor that there's an open season on cougar in Utah, who would be the natural predators of the deer. And the interesting thing is, when you talk to a lot of hunters, And they will tell you that they're really out to save the deer. After all, we've got this overpopulation problem. They're saving the deer from starvation. Interesting thing about that is whenever the Fish and Game Department has a shortfall of the number of deer, there are a lot of very angry hunters who didn't get a chance to save these deer from starvation. Let's go on to a subject that Dr. Youngblood has touched on, and that is a question of meat consumption. The meat consumption of members is higher than average, at least in Utah, higher than the average Gentile, shall we say, the average in this country. And yet, there are quite a number of admonishments, like in section 49, where it says, "Woe be unto men that sheddeth blood, or that wasteth flesh and hath no need." We've talked about the meaning of the word of wisdom. A lot of people try to get around this by playing word games. The leaders of the church have been abundantly clear about what the word of wisdom means, and yet at least in my area in California, we always have barbecues and everything else in summer. There's absolutely no attention paid to the idea of trying to cut down on meat, and we always try to go to the very edge, try to see what we can get away with. It's kind of like Diet Coke or you know, the caffeine and cola, and we always want to know how far can we stretch the limits, how much meat can we eat. Well, the whole idea of the word of wisdom is it is set up for the weakest of those who can call themselves saints. This is not the ideal law. This is kind of the bare minimum structure that people are expected to follow. And it does say that grain is supposed to be the staff of life. Now, if you ask somebody, what are you having for lunch or dinner, do they say buckwheat burgers or something? I mean, obviously, we do not use grain as the staff of life. As far as using it in time of need, the reality is, anybody who's been in the health field as I have, that there is no nutritional requirement for meat. There are a lot of deleterious effects. And there are a lot of other reasons not to eat meat, because it has very negative impact on the environment. A lot of the pollution problems come from raising animals. As members of the church, we bear a responsibility, since we bear a lot of children, for offsetting that impact on world hunger, because in order to eat a pound of beef, it takes 16 pounds of grain. Consequently, if Americans would trim their diets of meat by 10%, we could feed adequately 60 million people in the world. So if we're looking for a way to combat world hunger, cutting down our meat consumption would be very helpful. There's an LDS nutritionist, Dr. Pavel Airola, under whom I studied, and he wrote quite a number of books. Some of you may be familiar with him. You spell his last name A-I-R-O-L-A. You can get his books in any health food store, some other regular bookstores. His classic work is called How to Get Well, which is a compilation of ways to heal various diseases naturally. And he joined the church because he had already independently and scientifically come to the conclusions that the word of wisdom outlines, namely that grain is supposed to be the most important part of the diet and that we should eat relatively little meat. The basic point about a vegetarian diet is that it's not to be a commandment. But a lot of people confuse that because people don't read the scriptures carefully when it talks about that we're not supposed to forbid the eating of meat. They confuse that with an idea that vegetarianism is forbidden. Obviously, it is not, because half a dozen of the prophets were vegetarian or near vegetarian. And perhaps Dr. Youngblood can comment a little further about his point of view on a vegetarian diet. Any other comments?
I do not come by my vegetarian diet honestly. In 1982, I was 50 at the time. My high blood pressure had finally gotten to the point where I would have to take medication for it. It had been creeping up on me since the time that I was 45, and I was 50 at that time. I had an assistant who is an animal rights activist, and had been pounding on me for years about how wrong I was to eat flesh. And I happened to get a book by Dr. John McDougall, a well-known internist, called The McDougall Plan for Health and Long Life. And in there, he outlined the contribution of eating animal fat and protein to high blood pressure. And I read this book avidly since I had studied medicine, well, at this time for 32 years, and I was very interested in anything that might contribute to my own health. It took me some 3 months to become a vegetarian. It's not easy once you have become accustomed to throwing a piece of meat in a frying pan. It's a very easy way to prepare your meal. It actually is not as easy as the way I prepare my meals now, but you have to learn a new cultural consciousness and how to do it, because Mom always taught you to throw a hamburger patty on the frying pan and throw some mustard and ketchup on it and a white bun. You had lunch. Took me 3 months to learn how to be a vegetarian. I found 6 months later that if I ate meat, because I went to a hospital dinner and they always have nothing but filet mignon, and so I ate a little bit of this filet mignon, and for 2 days I had a bellyache. That taught me right quick that my body had unadjusted to something that babies must adjust to, which is to eat meat. One of the reasons that babies have so much colic and difficulty when they're infants is because we're trying to feed them things that their bodies are not prepared to eat. A lot of the allergies and other diseases and problems that our little ones go through are because we feed them meat. There are two studies that I've been very impressed with. One was of 2,000 vegetarian people in Germany. And the other one is the Cornell-Oxford China study, which is ongoing since 1983, of about 6,500 Chinese people. The Chinese people are very appropriate for this kind of study because they have very localized, very well-established routines of eating, and they don't eat meat. Out of these two studies, it has become apparent that vegetarian people have a very, very low rate of cancer, heart disease, kidney disease, blood vessel disease, and many of the chronic diseases that we suffer from in this country. And that has been my own experience, because although occasionally when I get under stress, my blood pressure will go up somewhat, my blood pressure is today better than it was when I was in the U.S. Navy at 19 years of age. And I feel stronger, more energetic, more enthusiastic. I have more endurance than I have ever had in my life. The thing that strikes me the most about modern medicine and the vegetarian diet is that it comes on approximately 100 years after Joseph Smith gave us this gift of the Word of Wisdom. It is a great hypocrisy in our church that Mormon people can read the first page of the Word of Wisdom but cannot read and understand the second page of it, because it is clear that a high-fiber diet based on grains, beans, vegetables is what God has decreed as the best diet for men.
One of the reasons for that might be that anatomically, human beings are closer to herbivores than carnivores. If you look at the length of the intestine and the jaw and a lot of other things, we're really not set up to eat meat, which would conform to the point that Joseph Fielding Smith made about how prior to the flood, human beings did not eat meat. The vegetarian diet and meat eating have been very extensively studied. As I mentioned, Dr. Airola's How to Get Well has a lot of documentation in it, linking meat to cancer, heart disease, arthritis, and so forth. And I noticed a couple of other quick quotes on this subject. Parley P. Pratt: "Flesh and blood were never sanctioned to glut their souls or to gratify man's appetites." Lorenzo Snow said that he thought the Word of Wisdom was, quote, "violated as much or more in the improper use of meat as in other things, and thought the time was near at hand when the Latter-day Saints should be taught to refrain from meat eating and the shedding of animal blood," unquote. Now that we've dealt with the uncontroversial stuff, we're going to tackle another topic that is even more sensitive in some respects. and that has to do with scientific experiments on animals. Now, this is also a subject that needs the most secular treatment. Hugh Nibley would undoubtedly say that the philosophy which lies behind vivisection or animal experimentation is that of Satan, namely, that the end justifies the mean. Now, my message is that the end, in fact, is a fraud because the claims that are made for the benefits of vivisection are false. However, even if they were true, I think it is the hallmark of Satan to tempt people into doing things that cross a certain ethical barrier. The Nazis, hundreds of very respected doctors were recruited to experiment not just on Jews, but Russians, Poles, and so forth, and they came to see these people as subhuman, essentially as animals, and they felt they were doing work for the greater good. There was some very valuable research that came out of the Nazi medical experiments on hypothermia and so forth. So one first has to look at one's ethical principles. Unfortunately, Latter-day Saints have become so secularized that this has to be dealt with pretty much on a secular basis. BYU conducts animal experiments. Members of the church have been prominent in heart disease research and so forth. And so we need to address this from the standpoint of the average secularized member and talk a little bit about the rationale behind animal experimentation. Most of the people who defend it or who are inclined to support it really are not familiar with what goes on behind the laboratory doors, nor does the vivisection lobby want you to know. If you're interested in reading examples of experiments, I'd suggest picking up Peter Singer's Animal Liberation. It's paperback you can get almost anywhere. He said this was the most difficult chapter for him to write because the just reading about what is done will turn your stomach if you have any sensitivity at all. A great deal of the experiments are done without anesthesia. My brother went to UCLA Medical School, and I know some of the things that were done there. We're talking about flaying conscious dogs alive. Primates are treated in such a way that Jane Goodall, who's the chimpanzee expert, said it was the most nightmarish experience of her life to go into this primate center back east. I won't read you some of the horrifying examples. I'll leave that to your own morbid curiosity, but I would suggest that anybody who defends vivisection should actually go read about it because when it's talked about in public, the vivisectors will say that they love animals, they treat them well, they give anesthesia, which is a lie. I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said that anyone who vivisects will not hesitate to lie about it. The problem, first of all, presents itself in that we don't even know how many animals are killed each year. In the U.S. alone, it's probably between 60 and 100 million animals who are killed through animal experiments. Frankly, the killing is the least of it. It's the torture that is the most horrendous problem. The industry is a $6 to $10 billion business, and at every step of the way, it has fought reform. It has fought the introduction of anesthesia. The Animal Welfare Act is not enforced. It was passed 20 years ago to try and protect lab animals. These scientists who claim that they love these animals fight every step that is designed to protect them because they see it as a bother. And I could quote you some of the leading vivisectors to the effect that they really, in fact, don't care about the subject. What has brought about some change has been political pressure. Interesting thing is that Congress has received more mail on the subject of vivisection than any other issue in its history, including the Vietnam War. So this is a very volatile issue, needless to say. I might add that in the 1988 Republican platform, there was actually a section about pushing for alternatives to testing. Now, the interesting thing about the case for vivisection is the number of defectors from it. Michael Allen Fox wrote a book called The Case for Animal Experimentation. He is now one of the most prominent anti-vivisection activists. There are a number of former vivisectors who now head anti-vivisection groups, and there are thousands of doctors, medical doctors around the world who are working against this. I mention this because one of the favorite ploys of the vivisection lobby is to set this up as these humane medical doctors on one side who are out to save suffering humanity, and they really don't want to hurt animals, and on the other side are these irrational animal lovers who are well-intentioned, but they're going to harm humanity. One of the most foremost physicians in Britain, Dr. Vernon Coleman, said, "I cannot think of a single major breakthrough that was produced as a result of an animal experiment." And the interesting thing about that is if you listen to the animal experimentation lobby, they will tell you that everything that we've learned has been due to experiments on animals. Part of the misunderstanding here is that many of these things could have been researched by other means. They were researched using animals because that was the way to get the money. This is an entrenched bureaucracy. We have alternatives, for example, on cosmetic testing that are cheaper, faster, more effective, more accurate in predicting any harm to human beings. The problem is we're dealing with a bureaucracy that's been entrenched for a number of decades. It's very hard for them mentally to switch over. There's a lot of money, $6 to $10 billion a year, wrapped up in this whole business. So even when there are better alternatives, it's been a real struggle to try to get them to be adopted. For example, the Dreyse test, where they will take any kind of substance and put it in a rabbit's eye and then kill the rabbit and see how much eye damage it did and so forth. There are actually better products out, artificial products and also chick membranes that would serve more effectively, and yet these things have not been adopted. The lethal dose, or lethal dose 50 or LD50 test is used very widely in testing household products. The idea is that you give an animal enough until it kills 50% of the group. Now, as somebody once said, why is it necessary to know how many tubes of toothpaste will kill a population of beagles? And how many rabbits do you have to kill with Drano before you can say it's not good stuff to eat? It's a very stupid test that has gradually been changing. Right now it kills about 5 million animals a year. Once we get away from cosmetic and household product testing, then you get into sticky areas about medical research from the past. And if you go through each of the claims for vivisection, you find that they just don't hold water. Now, a few of the things I'm going to tell you here are going to be sound pretty radical, but I can guarantee you that these are all backed up with tremendous medical research. Thousands of medical doctors have endorsed these statements. For example, one of the things you will hear is that insulin was produced by animal experiments. That's not true. It was produced by clinical experiments. Later animal experiments were done to purportedly validate the human experiments. But insulin actually isn't terribly good because the diabetes fatality rate did not decrease from the use of insulin. Lives were extended a little bit, but it's actually a very damaging substance for a number of biochemical reasons. And using animal-extracted insulin actually retarded the progress towards a non-animal insulin that can now be used and is much safer. And there are also natural alternatives to using insulin for diabetes. I have personally been involved with doctors when I was an apprentice to Dr. Arola, and saw many people cured of diabetes. Generally, 4 out of 5 people who have it are overweight, at least for the adult onset version. What we're dealing with here is a fundamentally different medical vision. It's not the good doctors versus the ignorant layman. There are different models of medicine. As I said, Dr. Airolo's book, Dr. McDougall's book that Dr. Youngblood mentioned, outline lots of ways that you can approach healing without resorting to orthodox medical therapies, and they're much, much more effective. What probably the favorite myth has to do with vaccines. Most people assume that polio, smallpox, and so forth were conquered by vaccines. Actually, if you look at the data on the reduction of the infectious diseases, you'll see that they started falling quite rapidly before vaccines were introduced, and they disappeared from areas that received no vaccination at all. Now, this sounds pretty radical, but it's just a matter of looking at it, the historical data. Most doctors who talk about it are not familiar with that. This is something you can also check out and Dr. Robert Sharp's book, The Cruel Deception, which is distributed, I believe, by the National Anti-Vivisection Society. It's very well documented on the subject of vaccines. You'll notice that the bubonic plague, leprosy, a lot of other major infectious diseases disappeared without vaccination campaigns, because what happens is that the viruses mutate over a period of time and gradually disappear on their own anyway. There were also other factors involved in this. Dr. Jacob Weissman at the UCLA Medical School, where my brother attended, in a book called Choose to Live, argues that the introduction of industrial chemicals played an important role in combating infectious diseases. Most experts would say that probably sanitation was the biggest factor in reducing smallpox. And I might add that vaccinations have been pretty strongly implicated in AIDS and in multiple sclerosis, among other things. On the subject of cancer, I can quote you many, many eminent doctors, Dr. James Watson, who said that the public has been sold a bill of goods on cancer, that we've gained basically nothing out of all these years of cancer research. The improving survival rate, incidentally, is due to earlier detection and not to better treatment. Dr. Hardin Jones of the University of Berkeley did a very long-time study which showed that those who were not treated for cancer actually lived longer than those who were treated. And in Dr. Airola's How to Get Well, he outlines quite a number of the alternative treatments. Again, I personally have been familiar with about 1,000 doctors in this country who have worked on cancer patients and have had a much higher survival rate. But you're dealing with a very entrenched bureaucracy on these things, and frankly, one has to read these books to understand the differing medical models and why some medical doctors will think one way and one another. Most of the doctors who were involved, I would say all of the doctors who were involved in treating with alternative therapies, at one time were orthodox allopathic physicians. They went through the same medical training as everybody else, but something happened in their life. Either a loved one grew ill, they were unable to treat the individual, or they may have had a personal illness that they weren't able to overcome. And as Dr. Youngblood said, might have been heart disease, or it might have been a high blood pressure or something like that. And then the mind became open and became exposed. Unfortunately, most doctors do not have much exposure to nutrition. My brother had one course, one semester, one course in his entire training. Dr. Weissman shows quite conclusively in Choose to Live. And again, this is a guy who is on the staff at the UCL Medical School. He said that it's a common assumption that cancer was a rare disease in the past and that now we're living longer and we have better detection. But first of all, as far as living longer goes, if you look back 150 years, anybody who survived to 45 would live to the biblical age of 70 anyway. It's not so much the living longer or even better diagnosis, because he goes back and shows that at one point, probably in the last century, it was maybe cancer was responsible for maybe 2% of the deaths, and now it could be as many as one out of three eventually could die from cancer, or at least contract cancer. The World Health Organization says that 85% of cancer is due to environmental factors, including diet. The former deputy director of the National Cancer Institute's Division of Cause and Prevention said half of the cancers are diet-related. Again, this goes back to the word of wisdom. There's a very definite dietary link. It's also ethically obscene to kill hundreds of thousands of dogs to prove that smoking is harmful. I think this should be something of particular meaning to Latter-day Saints, but dogs don't naturally smoke. We've got plenty of people who do, so we should stick to clinical studies if we don't believe that it's dangerous. There are also a lot of really absurd uses of animals. I remember when cyclamates were tested, and they came out and said that you'll die of cancer if you use cyclamates in 800 cans of soda pop a day. The whole approach, as many medical doctors have said, to utilization of animals is extremely crude. Many former vivisectors have said that now that they've seen the light, they think that really the future of scientific research should be in using non-animal models. One of the reasons we haven't made a lot of the progress in The cancer area, according to Dr. Erwin Bross, who headed up one of the chief cancer research institutes, is that each species' immune system is different. And so what we're finding in animals really doesn't apply generally to humans. Called Cancer Research on Animals by Dr. Brandon Rhines, which is distributed by the American Anti-Vivisection Society out of Chicago, that goes into this in more detail. Finally, on the subject of cancer, how about the testing of dangerous chemicals? Well, the fact is you can show over and over and over that a majority of the things that are actually marketed that have cleared the animal hurdle end up being withdrawn from the market because of side effects that were not anticipated in human beings. There are non-animal methods of testing now and screening drugs that are cheaper, faster, more accurate. And frankly, it's the only way that you can screen these things because the animal methods take so long to do, say 3 years, $150,000, that they're not practical. And right now, most of the 30,000 things that are on the market have not been adequately tested. It's very difficult to even keep up with the several thousand new drugs and chemicals that are coming on the market each year. And a lot of this stuff really isn't needed. The World Health Organization said that, in their opinion, only 210 drugs were actually necessary for human health. The Medical Research Modernization Committee and the Physicians for Responsible Medicine are two physicians groups which go into considerably excruciating detail on any of this stuff if anybody's interested. Don't argue with me on it. Talk to the doctors who hold these viewpoints. Finally, let me just close on this with a statement from Henry Bigelow of the Harvard School of Medicine. A day will come when the world will look upon today's vivisection in the name of science the way we look upon witch hunts in the name of religion. And I'm sorry to take up so much on that rather secular topic, but I do think it's something that very few people understand. You can agree or disagree. I would suggest looking at some of the books I've mentioned, making your own judgments about it. Dr. Youngblood, do you want to make any comments on the subject of animal experimentation?
Sure.
Then we'll open it up for questions after.
I would direct my comments more to vivisection than specifically to animal experimentation. How can surgeons learn their skills without animal surgery? My own first experience with animal surgery was at the age of 29. I was a third-year medical student. I was a late bloomer. I'd served 4 years in the Navy. I was on my surgery rotation for my junior year in medical school, and we had what was called dog lab surgery. And a group of four medical students were assigned to do a procedure, one of the procedures that we were studying, on an animal. One student would anesthetize the animal, two would do the surgery, and the third one would do the autopsy. And it was my experience to do the autopsy, so I saw the results of the surgery. If your animal did not live through your surgery and until the time that you did the autopsy, obviously you didn't get a very good grade. One of our fellow students got very concerned about our dog, who was not doing well, and it was not allowed to give antibiotics to the animals. But he sneaked in and gave the animal some antibiotics, and the animal lived till the time that I was assigned to put the animal to sleep and do the autopsy, which I did. Found that the surgery was, basically the standard of what we were doing. That was my first animal surgery. It was also my last animal surgery. Then how do we learn the skills of surgery? Now, I'm a plastic surgeon. I've been practicing plastic surgery since 1967. And I have never once done practice animal surgery during that time. Obviously, I cannot blow my own horn and say that I'm a great plastic surgeon. If anybody is to do that, it must be my patients. However, I am very proud of the surgery that I do, and I feel that I have at least the skills of any plastic surgeon. We learn our surgery by doing it on human beings, because there are basic things that we do, like sewing up scalp lacerations on drunks in the emergency room, especially on Friday and Saturday nights. And that doesn't require a great deal of skill. But you learn some basic skills in doing so. I started doing that when I was a senior medical student. And it progressed by increments, slowly. Each procedure that required a little bit more skill, you had perfected, and the lesser procedures. Now, I cannot speak for chest surgeons who do heart surgery, because they claim that they must operate on lambs and calves and that sort of thing to perfect their heart surgery. I cannot speak to that. But I feel that plastic surgery is one of the most skilled surgical specialties that we have. And yet, with the background that I have, with the skills that I have never once had to do surgery on an animal.
We'll take some questions. I might add that Britain turns out not only some of the best surgeons in the world, but also has been an innovator in surgery. A lot of the surgical procedures were invented in Britain. You can go down a whole, and they don't use animals. You can go down a whole list of alternatives to standards, mechanical models, the use of film so that you don't have to repeat things in classes, gas chromatography, clinical studies, postmortems, eliminating the pointless duplication in experiments, better test design, organ tissue cultures. There are just zillions and zillions of alternatives. Again, if anybody is interested in the subject, there are books on the subject I'd be glad to recommend, but we don't want to dwell too much on this because this really is more of a secular debate. Okay, we can open this up to any questions you might have.
I have two questions. One, you mentioned hunting, but you didn't mention animal experimentation.
Yeah. Well, economics is not the only factor. I think anybody who has come up against a very biased establishment, whether it's archaeology, medicine, astronomy, whatever, you're dealing with some entrenched positions, and economics is not the only factor. There's a lot of money in animal experimentation. The fact that it is cheaper to do the experiments for drug testing, for example, is a positive factor. But most of the people in the business of vivisection aren't really that familiar with it. It will become one of the factors that will persuade people, and already a lot of the cosmetic companies have stopped doing some of these tests. As far as fishing goes, various statements from the Prophet make it clear that we should treat fish like other animals. I mean, they may be of lesser importance as non-mammals, but you shouldn't fish unnecessarily. But if you're going to fish, it's up to the individual conscience to judge on that. Fish is less damaging than meat, but there are a lot of problems with fish, too, in terms of the health, the pollution, and so forth. But it's a very secondary issue, in my opinion. I'd say let's get to first base, and then we can argue about the secondary issues like that. You have any comments on that?
Sure. Fishing has become a hazardous sport because with all the pollution that we have in our oceans and lakes and rivers and so forth today, there are a lot of contaminants in the fish that you consume. One of the arguments for using fish is the fact that certain cold water fish have a high concentration of omega-3 oil in their tissues, and that this omega-3 oil is very beneficial for lowering cholesterol and helping with blood vessel and heart disease. The only problem with that, well, not the only, but the greatest problem with that argument is that fish are not the very best source of omega-3 oil. Flaxseed is.
Right. Yeah. Anything that doesn't have a face, she doesn't eat. Okay. When I was about 8 years old, I liked eating fish, and I went to Knott's Berry Farm, and they had a fishing pond there, and for the first time, I went fishing, and I threw in my bait, and it was reeled out, and the guy came over who was supervising this and took some pliers and beat the heck out of this fish and killed it and then gutted it right in front of me. Now, I was appalled at what I saw, And that kind of turned me off to fish. And a few weeks later, there was a Latter-day Saint fishing expedition out to the sea. And, of course, all these big fish were thrown on board, and everybody had fun going after them. My attitude is that fish are animals, and no animal should be killed unnecessarily. Now, it's up to the individual to decide what necessarily means. You may decide that you want to get cockroaches out of your house one way or the other. I would say, generally, one should adopt a conservative attitude. We don't know a lot about pain in animals. We can make certain assumptions that those without a central nervous system aren't going to feel pain and so forth. But frankly, we know all animals have souls. And it isn't just pain that's the issue. Like the prophets have said, all animals have a right to live. They're not here for our use, I might add, because most animals never have any contact with us. If you really want to talk about insects and in the darkest Africa and so forth, very few animals have contact with us. Therefore, we should adopt reverence for life. Again, I would say, let's get to square one where everybody agrees we ought to treat animals kindly, and then we can have all the little debates in Sunday school about what that means.
Specifically to the question about fish not having a central nervous system. Any creature that has a complex muscle system, and especially those which have a spine, as most fish do, has a central nervous system.
Incidentally, I used to edit Vegetarian World, and then I was associate editor of Vegetarian Times, and we used to call those vegetarians fishitarians. Right. Right. The statement was read from Joseph Smith about eating cod, I believe it was, and that it wasn't a violation of the Word of Wisdom. There are a couple of answers. One is, obviously, some of the church leaders that I read would disagree with him. There is room for disagreement on the whole subject of what you can eat, what you cannot eat. Now, whether it's a violation of the Word of Wisdom or not, there are some health considerations in not eating fish. Again, fish have souls, we're told. They shouldn't be killed unnecessarily. If you're going to eat any kind of meat, including fish, don't do it unnecessarily. Now, what defines necessity? Dr. Airola shows quite conclusively in How to Get Well and Elsewhere that there is no fish or meat that is necessary. Grains, vegetables, and fruits supply everything you need. And I might say that the old myths about needing to combine your foods to get protein and that you have to get B12 from animal products is absolute nonsense. These are based on research done by the very objective meat and dairy industry. Yeah.
Under the section of sacrifice, and it looks like it's coming back.
Yeah. Okay, animal sacrifice, is it coming back? Because Joseph did make one statement about everything being restored, including animal sacrifice. My opinion is Joseph got over-enthusiastic about restoring all things. The reason is it's pretty clear what the whole meaning of the great and last sacrifice was. Now, it's possible sacrifice of animals could be reintroduced at one moment to technically fulfill the idea of everything being restored, but it'd be quite pointless. Certainly, it's not compatible with the millennium or the hereafter. There is a book out, if anybody has an interest in this subject, called The Slaughter of Terrified Beast by a Protestant theologian, a Mormon friend who helped me found the LDS Reverence for Life group. Says that it's an incredibly well-documented book that shows that the whole way sacrifice was pursued in the Old Testament really was incorrect theologically and so forth. I haven't read the book. She was very impressed with it and said for members of the church, they'll be startled by reading a lot of the documentation there. It's not another one of these faddist kind of things where they try to make the evidence fit their conclusion. So if anybody is particularly interested in sacrifice, you might want to pursue that. It's also possible that animals that were sacrificed had their pain divinely lessened or something like that. I don't think it's a big issue today at the moment. I think we got a lot of other things to worry about, but it is an issue that should be pursued, I think. We didn't cover it here because there's just so much we can cover. Let me take somebody else here. Yeah.
I think that standpoint, I wish somebody was here from the social.
Right. The question had to do with what can be done about inculcating the idea of reverence for life in children. As we mentioned, the church had Humane Day program. They had a Be Kind to Animals program, a Bird Day up through the time of David O. McKay. And these things are not done now. A group of us specifically proposed to the church that Humane Day be reactivated, not with all these controversial stuff we're talking about, but with the basic statements that were done for Humane Day in the church in the past in primary. Now, there are a fair number of lessons. I've got a list here from the church curriculum department which deal with that. However, I don't think it's adequate. I think we ought to reinstitute Humane Day in primary and let people, you know, let the kids know that it is an issue and to think about it. The point was made that when you teach your children, you got to face the fact that they're going to become so sensitive that they'll be horrified by a lot of the things that most people take for granted. It's a question of how far you pursue it. I didn't really say anything to my son. And he grew up and ended up going vegetarian on his own and so forth. I don't like to kill insects. I try to avoid it. We used to get out where I live in kind of a rural area. We used to get rodents, and we would trap them live and take them way out in the sticks and let them go. You know, I try to avoid it when I can. There are some painful dilemmas that come in, and sometimes you have to steel yourself, like when I deflea my dog, you know. I don't worry too much about the fleas. I just don't think about it. But there are some issues there with making your kids too sensitive, and you have to figure out, again, I think what we ought to do is let's do what we talked about, Humane Day. Let's just make cruelty an issue. I mean, there's a lot of cruelty in Utah, just plain old sadism and kids going out shooting birds for the heck of it. Let's stop this stuff. Let's get it to that level where we agree that animals have a right to live and not be tortured. And then, you know, all these other issues we can, a few years from now, we can convene together and talk about these finely divided points here. Any comment?
Yes. As parents, it is very difficult for us to allow our children to experience their own pain. Yet it is my belief that the greatest lessons that we learn in this life are through our pain.
No. The church has never had like a blessing of the animals on St. Francis's Day or anything, any real acknowledgement in that way. But we do have the best theology, the best quotes, and so forth of any church. We just don't apply it. Yeah. Yeah, this kind of ties into the last question about blessings of animals and stuff. Yes, members of the church have blessed animals. I've seen it happen. I've done it myself to alleviate suffering, you know, to get well, any of the normal things. Early church leaders did it. I think Mary Fielding Smith did it over one of her oxen. Animals can be blessed. It's perfectly acceptable. It's just that we've become so secularized, we no longer think that it's appropriate.
But you talked about oil, which I assume
yeah.
was a priesthood.
Yeah, it can be done also with priesthood oil. Animals can be blessed. We've had our dogs blessed on occasion, too. Right there, yeah.
Since I'm personally not LDS, I would like to know, personally, they like to propagate their speech. What do they feel about that?
Just to repeat the question, since members like to propagate themselves, do they believe in spaying and neutering of animals?
I'm not aware of any church position on that. I personally subscribe to it because of the suffering of animals that it alleviates because of the proliferation of animals that are not cared for in our community.
I think you have to keep in... Well, okay, the position is that members are totally secular here. I know one member of the church who doesn't believe in spaying and neutering, but all the LDS veterinarians do it, and there are a lot of them. And I think the attitude is, first of all, pets are artificial. Pets are domesticated. They're not natural animals. You do have to deal with population control, and as we start to overrun wildlife habitats and so forth, I mean, the issue of controlling animals, whether domestic or wild, comes up, and it's part of our stewardship to deal with that, one way or the other. Let me give you, yeah. Okay, well, first of all, you generally don't have cougar running all over the place. They generally don't come down into urban areas. My opinion is that the livestock that are killed by cougar, which are relatively few, should be part of the risk of doing business, like theft out of pay. God presumably knew what he was doing when he set up the natural balance. Every time we tinker with it, things get screwed up. We should adhere to that as much as possible. Now, let me give you an example where we intervene improperly. The bunny hunts up in Idaho. Members of the church got terrible publicity 20 years ago because the church award decided to do a fundraising project by going out and killing the rabbits. And what they would do is they would go out with these clubs, baseball bats, and so forth, and they would have fun going around. Masses of these rabbits would be herded in, and all of the primary kids and so forth would take bats and go out there and have fun and glee. There were photos all over AP and so forth of this ward doing a fundraising project, people having fun, hitting the bunnies over the head. The interesting thing about it is it was the wrong thing to do because the rabbits will die out automatically from a stress disease when they get to a certain point. There's a natural regulation that's involved there. This can also happen with the deer. Now, let's say it's justified since we've tinkered with the environment to go out and kill the deer. You could do it several ways. First of all, you could have professional hunters do it to take them out carefully instead of hunting fever taking over. It would be safer and better. And then you could give the meat to the poor or anybody who really needed it. Or members of the church can go out and kill the deer if they think it's really necessary, but they shouldn't enjoy it, and they do. And if you read what the prophet said about killing unnecessarily being a sin akin to murder, we're talking heavy-duty stuff here. We better look at why we enjoy this killing. Yeah?
I guess my feeling is I would rather see a deer shot, say, by a professional hunter than starving to death.
Well, actually, I don't know which is more painful. One of the problems with hunting is usually it's not a quick kill. Usually the animal gets wounded and struggles for miles. You know, it's pretty messy business if anybody has seen this actually happen. Let us not enjoy the hunt as a starter and then see how much hunting is done. And if people feel it's necessary, so be it.
I have a comment.
Yeah. Because they're in the business of keeping hunters happy. Like I say, hunters get very angry when they can't save the deer from starvation. Also, again, if you want to talk to the Fund for Animals, they have some publications out on hunting showing that the majority of hunting is a big business where the predators are trimmed back and wildlife is encouraged and so forth. But we're basically theoretically out of time. Now, I would say that we would love to take as many questions as you have. So those of you who aren't starving for lunch and want to stay here, just keep raising your hands and we'll handle all the questions.
I wanted to make one comment to this idea about the hunt to save the crops. My personal feeling is that doing a wrong to supposedly set something right does not really set it right. I think that God has given us creativity, ingenuity, the intelligence to do something beyond go kill something because it's causing us some economic cost. If we can send satellites around planets, do all of the things that we do, why can we not learn how to fence in our crops, how to control the animals in a way that we can feed them, we can let nature take its course and not go out and become murderers?
Do either of you believe in feeding a starving deer?
Oh, I believe in feeding anything that's starving.
At the very back in the purple dress. Yes, you. Right.
No, I just had a comment about the point that they should be allowed.
The point was made that we are the ones who are interfering in the animals' natural habitats, and we should take some responsibility for that. Again, when you go back and read Brigham Young and some of these church leaders, I mean, these statements are radical. I mean, they criticize somebody like Wayne Owens for being an environmentalist and off to the left on the environment in the Sierra Club. The prophet's statements are a heck of a lot more radical. Brigham Young even said, hey, if the grasshoppers want to come and eat our crops, let them. They killed the crickets when he wasn't around, incidentally.
Go ahead. We have displaced nature in a mammoth way, and we continue to displace nature. And I don't think that to continue to borrow from nature to try to correct that displacement is going to get us anywhere except into catastrophe and disaster.
Yeah, the point was made that hunters hunt because they like the sport. The money they spend on it ought to be turned over to the various organizations that could handle the situation more humanely, and that maybe if they weren't hunting, maybe they'd take out their aggressions on their wives and kids.
Well, one of the prophets made, a very astute comment about how women should be very careful as to the kind of man that they choose for a husband, because any man who abuses animals and presumably is about the greatest abuse that you can do will also abuse the wife.
Next question. Anybody else with a question here? Yeah.
Yeah. You
right. If you want to know about that book on sacrifice, The Slaughter of Terrified Beasts, you have to give me your address, name and address, and just put sacrifice on there, and I'll get the details where you get it. I think it's a $15 book, and I heard about it right before I left, didn't have a chance to really look it up, but I understand it's very impressive. Yeah, the point is made about animal sacrifice being a disturbing thing for anybody getting involved, not only in our religion, but any Judeo-Christian tradition that has that background. Why did God allow this and so on? Frankly, we'll have to read the book. We could speculate, but nobody really knows. I think the important thing is that it's been a dead issue, no pun intended, for the last 2,000 years, so I'm not too worried about it at this point. There's enough sacrifice going on during hunting season that I got bigger things to worry about. Anybody else? Any other comments? Well, yes, would we accept non-Mormons in an LDS Reverence for Life group? We'll take anybody. We can't get the Mormons in it, so we'll have to get the non-Mormons in it, I guess. Guess that's it. Thanks for coming.
Right. You give me $3 and your name and address, and I'll send you a copy of it.